We all want a business like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Businesses where once a customer engages with them, it becomes automatic and a part of their lifestyle from then on. But how do you build that forever transaction? I'm Robbie Kelman Baxter, and I have been studying subscription and membership models for nearly 20 years. In this podcast, my guests and I share the secrets and strategies of the membership economy. Join us for Subscription Stories, True Tales from the Trenches. Today, I'm joined by Adam Mayer, SVP of Monetization at Chess.com. Chess.com is one of the most popular freemium platforms in the world, offering millions of users free access to an engaging online chess experience. But how do you encourage players to upgrade to a paid tier when the free version is already so compelling? Adam, with his extensive background in revenue strategy and subscription growth, has played a critical role in designing and optimizing Chess.com's premium offerings. In this conversation, we'll dive into the challenges and opportunities of building a successful paid tier within a thriving freemium ecosystem. We'll discuss how Chess.com balances free and premium value, the strategies they've used to convert free users into loyal subscribers, and the key lessons Adam has learned from his experience leading revenue at a fast-growing digital platform. If you're interested in learning how to drive revenue without alienating your free user base, how to craft subscription tiers that meet diverse customer needs, and how to foster long-term loyalty in a competitive market, you won't want to miss this episode. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hi, Robbie. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled to have you. You were actually a recommendation by a past guest, which is super fun to have. So I'm really glad we got your story and I'm really looking forward to it.
No, I'm excited. So hopefully a fun story to talk about.
So let's just start with, you know, this is Subscription Stories. We have subscription practitioners, subscription experts. Tell us how you came to be a subscription practitioner and I would say expert.
Yeah, well, I've been in media and technology for most of my 20-year career. And about 10 to 15 years ago, I was at Time Warner Cable, which is obviously a subscription-based company. And one of my roles there was to launch and run the new smart home security space, which was home security with thermostats, lights, a lot of the stuff that we take for granted now, remote, of course. And that was a subscription model. So that was my first kind of really running a subscription business. It was very different than what I'm doing today, and we could talk about it a little bit. And then after that, I worked at WWE, the wrestling
company. Which is?
Yes, the wrestling company. No, I was not a wrestler, despite my best attempts. But there I ran the business side of WWE Network, which was WWE's subscription-based streaming service. It was basically Netflix with wrestling content. And again, from the business side, responsible for acquiring and retaining and messaging and marketing to subscribers. So spent 4 or 5 years there. It was amazing, great business. And then from there, came to Chess.com, which again is primarily a subscription-based business model. And I've been here for now 3.5 years. So it's been a good 10 plus years in the subscription space, which is a fun place to be in.
Yeah. What made you go from WWE to Chess.com? I mean, it sort of seems like the through line, I guess, is you started at a telco, you moved to a streamer, and then Chess.com, like it feels like a big jump.
Yeah,
it feels
yeah.
like something different.
It's from the wrestling ring to the chessboard, right? Everyone says that's so different.
And they're all games.
Yeah, they're all games. So of course, there was a subscription business model that was a common thread through all of those. So I had that understanding. And there are certainly things that applies to all of the businesses. It was, they're all B2C. But I think what I really love about Chess.com and similar to WWE is there is a huge passion for the product, right? Whether it was wrestling or whether it's the game of chess, people just really loved it, felt very attached to it. There was an emotional tie to the product. And it's just great working somewhere where you are providing a product or a service that your customers love. And again, whether it was watching screaming fans outside the wrestling ring or reading our forums on chess.com about how much they love the game. Either way, it's just a great feeling and it's exciting. And being able to market and provide a product with that type of passion and fan base, there's many similarities between the two.
Now, I know you're being funny, but like you weren't a wrestler.
I was not.
But you are a chess player.
I play chess, yes. I am one of the worst chess players at chess.com, although in my last 3 years, I've definitely gotten better. But yes, I was a fan of wrestling, but I was not a wrestler. And chess, yeah, I was a casual chess player. And I think what happened specifically was in 2020, when I was still at WWE and starting to think about my next job, the pandemic occurred, which we all remember. And the other big thing for chess was on Netflix, there was the show The Queen's Gambit. So I was at home, great show, all about chess. So I was at home with my wife and we were watching The Queen's Gambit. And I was like, huh, I used to play chess a lot. Maybe I should start playing again. So I Googled chess and sure enough, chess.com was the first listing on the page. And I started playing and realized how much I loved the game because I used to play a lot when I was younger. And then I realized how interesting the company would be potentially and started a conversation with them and ended up here.
So you reached out to them. You were.
Yeah, it was actually an interesting experience. There was a job opening that was not the perfect fit for me, but I used that as kind of an excuse to reach out to them. And I talked to Eric, the CEO, founder and CEO, and some other folks about that role. And frankly, they rejected me. I didn't get the job, which wasn't surprising because it wasn't the right fit for me exactly, given my background. But they said, hey, Adam, this has been great chatting with you. We like you. Maybe in the future, there'll be other roles. Talk to us again 3 months from now. So I was like, okay. So 3 months later, I reached out to them. There wasn't a new role and said, hey, wanted to chat again. We spoke for another 2-3 weeks. Had great conversations, was very excited, and they rejected me again. So I was rejected for the second time. Again, it wasn't for a specific role, but it was just saying, hey, not the right time. We don't have anything right now for you. And then I guess 3 months later, or maybe even 4 months later, there was another role that was posted that wasn't exactly my role, but pretty similar to what my role is today. And I remember talking to my wife, and she was like, Adam, don't apply. You already got rejected twice. If they wanted you, they would have reached out. And I said, yeah, but you know what? I hear you. And I don't expect them to get back to me. But I just had such great conversations with them. It seems like such an amazing company. Let me reach out. So I reached out. They shockingly got back to me. And 3 weeks later, I got the job. So it was a 9-month process of 2 rejections and I guess I tricked them the third time because they took me.
And they still have you. And they still seem to love you three and a half years later.
So something's going right.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of really interesting points that I just want to tease out for our listeners. One of them is that senior level roles sometimes take a while to find the right fit, number one. Number two, I think it's really important for subscription pros to be reaching out to interesting subscription businesses, whether or not you're specifically looking for a job at that moment, for a few reasons. One is to become familiar with different models and learn some best practices, have peers that share some of the same challenges and opportunities that you do. And also because when you're looking for a new job, it's good to know the community.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a podcast about subscriptions, not about job seeking, but I will say that experience was a great learning experience for me about networking and being flexible. And I do think you alluded to this earlier, Robbie, you know, in more junior in your career, at least in my experience, it's much more set, like I'm looking for that job and I need that role. As you get more senior, both you, the job seeker, and I think the company who is looking to fill a job tend to be more flexible. Like I was applying for one role and I ended up in a different role. But even the role that I ended up with, what they posted, they changed a bit based on my qualification. So whether it's subscriptions or not, I do think the more senior you get, be aware that it's more fluid and conversations and networking and being open to different paths is much more important than when you're more junior and it's like, okay, I'm looking for this specific associate role or this specific marketing manager role. And it's much more cookie cutter.
Yeah, such a great point. I totally agree. When you joined Chess.com after that third job that was the charm, what was the situation there and what was your initial mandate? What did they ask you to do?
Yeah, so Chess.com is a really interesting organization. And one of the reasons I was so attracted to it and one of the reasons I still love it so much is because while Chess.com is a for-profit company, it is unbelievably mission-driven. And the mission of Chess.com is to grow the game of chess and to support the chess community. Eric Alabest, our CEO and founder, has obsessively focused on that mission since the founding almost 20 years ago. And there were really three things around that mission, three pillars, primary pillars beyond it. One was make the best product possible. Two was serve the community as best as possible, make sure the community experience and the user experience is amazing. And three, make sure this is the best place to work. What's interesting is what was not on those top three is the business, is revenue, is profit. Now, the company, to be clear, has always done well financially. It's always been profitable. It's always done nice revenue. And maybe you could argue it's because it hasn't focused so much on that. That's why they've done so well. Focus, you know, focus on the user, focus on the product, focus on your employees, and revenue will come. So a long background to say that my role was a brand new role, which was head of monetization. And the joke a little bit was that I'm the bad guy, right? I'm coming into this company that doesn't want to focus on money and revenue, and I'm going to be the evil money guy. Now, obviously, that's not how I'm viewed and not what I would want. So to answer your question in a long way, the mandate from Eric was, hey, look, as we are growing up, because this was right after the pandemic and the company was getting much bigger. So Eric and the company understood we need a bit more strategic thinking around our revenue and around revenue growth without sacrificing the mission. And that's really what was my mandate, was come in, help us grow our revenue, help us be more strategic about the revenue, but honor the mission, which is to grow the game of chess and support our amazing million, tens of millions, hundreds of millions size community.
So this is a challenge. It's funny. I've been working like you. I've been working in subscriptions a long time. And something that I noticed is that a lot of subscription businesses, a disproportionate amount of subscription businesses are mission-driven because they have that forever transaction. We're trying to improve the condition of our members in a particular area. And that's an ongoing challenge that they face. They're always trying to get better. They're always trying to get healthier, or they always have challenges with productivity, or it's an ongoing problem. And so a lot of these businesses are very focused, and you don't want to, you can look at it in the positive way of we all are here to serve a mission that we believe in. You can also look at it in a more cynical way and say, you don't want to eat the golden goose, right? If people are coming to you because they trust you, because they know you have their best interests at heart, and you become too mercenary, you might destroy the business. So this is, I think there are probably a lot of people listening who are experiencing this, whether they're at a professional association, whether they're at a gym, right? The goal of a gym, I mean, there's some scathing articles every year in January about the cynicism behind many gym owners. But really, when you think about what is a gym, or the CEO of CrossFit, Eric Rose, on the show a couple seasons ago, they're there to help people be healthy. That's the first goal. And the second goal is, and we need to be self-sustaining and maybe throw off some profit as well. A way that a lot of subscription businesses do that is by offering a lot of value for free.
Mm-hmm.
And I know chess.com offers quite a lot of value for
free. We certainly do. Yes.
So how do you, I mean, first of all, let's just talk about kind of numbers, ballpark figures. How does the audience break out in terms of free and premium? And can you talk a little bit about the distinctions between the two?
Sure. So we have almost 200 million registrants on chess.com. Now, they're not all active, but 200 million people since the founding to date, almost 200 million have signed up, given us their email, set up an account. There are about 35 million monthly active users, whether free or paid. Yeah, it's a real business and a real exciting destination and an amazing community. So we have three primary platforms, web, iOS, and Android, of course. That crosses all three of those. Like you mentioned, we're a freemium business model. So we have a free tier and a paid tier. We don't get into specific numbers or we don't share specific numbers of subscribers, but I'll just say the vast majority of our users are on the free tier. And to your point about the mission, like, that's wonderful. We want more people playing and loving and connecting with each other and with the game of chess. And our free tier enables them to do that without paying a dime. What you can do in our free tier is you can play as much chess with whoever around the world, with the 200 million registrants or the 30 million MAUs at any time. You just play a game and there's someone there to play totally for free. That will always be the case. We will always be letting you play for free. Our premium features enable you to improve your game with some tools. So we have things like puzzles. We have things like lessons. We have something called game review, which basically analyzes your game. Now, to be clear, and again, this gets to our mission, you can get puzzles, lessons, and game review for free. We have, but if you want unlimited, you then subscribe. So we really want to make sure that everyone, regardless of budget, can access this amazing game, play this amazing game, and get these incredible learning tools. And most people do that, and that's wonderful. The small percent who want it unlimited will subscribe, and that's wonderful also. I'll also add, we have advertisements on the free tier, and you remove the ads if you're on the paid tier. But honestly, our advertisements on the free tier is very minimal. We could make a lot more money on advertisements if we wanted to, but we choose not to because we're not trying to make the free tier bad to drive people to subscribe. We want people to enjoy that free experience.
So how do you think about packaging the different tiers, free versus paid, when what you have is so generous and rich for free and kind of delivers on your promise, right? You can play, you can actually even improve, you can learn to get better, you can, you know, lessons and puzzles and things to work on. How do you as an organization decide what goes behind the paywall and what stays in front of the paywall? And when it's time to, you know, there's this concept of a rule of 40, which is how much do you want your revenue to grow versus
margin,
your profitability? Yeah, your margin. And also the question of monthly active users. That number could be super high and both of those other numbers could stay flat, right? So what are the conversations like on your exec team when you're talking about, should we focus more on revenue growth, user growth, member satisfaction, or margin?
Yeah. So we view revenue not as a goal to enrich shareholders, to enrich executives, to enrich, to put us all on a beach someday. We view revenue as fuel for the mission. We want to make money and enough money so that we can reinvest it in the product, in our users, in our employees to further the mission. So when we have conversations about, well, do we need to balance the free growth versus revenue? It's really a question of how much revenue do we need to build, put back in the business to again grow this mission. Now, yes, there are certainly business factors going into play, and we have margins that we'd like to hit and revenue we'd like to hit. But unlike any other company I've worked at, it's not like, okay, we have got to hit this number. So do whatever you need to do to hit this number. So I just want to be clear that, and I'll come back and answer your question specifically about what goes behind the paywall. But at other companies, it's more about like, how do we maximize revenue, profitability, shareholder value? That's not the conversations we have here. Now, again, we are doing really well from revenue, profitability, and shareholder value. But it's not what drives the conversations. It's not what gets us to wake up in the morning. Maybe me a little bit more because of my role. I'm not going to lie. Like, part of my role is to have that focus. But overall, in our executive meetings and the company, that's not really how we think, which is quite refreshing, even though I'm kind of sometimes on the other side of it. But to answer your question about what goes in front of and behind the paywall, and also, like, how do you have a subscription business when you have such a compelling free product? And it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because on one hand, I'm trying to, now if I put business hat on, let's take the mission aside for a second. I'm trying to drive as many subscribers as possible, and I've got a very compelling free tier. So someone says, well, why should I upgrade when this free tier is great, especially when I can get game review, when I can get lessons, when I can get puzzles on the free tier? And guess what? A lot of people won't upgrade because of our amazing free tier, and that's just a reality. But on the flip side, by giving them such easy access to the game of chess and such easy access to taste our tools, right? I mean, you don't get them unlimited. You get one a day, you get one a week, etc. When the more people love chess and the more they use the tools on the free tier, the more likely they are going to be to upgrade. So at first, when I say, when I first got here, I was thinking, oh man, this free tier is so compelling. This is a real challenge for me. It's actually been somewhat the opposite. Our compelling free tier nurtures and grows the love of chess. And that's what gets people to subscribe. Because, I mean, clearly there is value to the paid tier. I mean, if there was no value, there'd be nothing. But the more they use the free, the more they love it and the more they want to upgrade. I mean, the thing that I think is amazing about a free tier, and some subscription services have and some don't, is we have a huge pool to market to. And it's not paid marketing, right? We've got our own marketing. We've got tens of millions of people that are the low-hanging fruit who will potentially upgrade. So it's actually a really good business model to have a really compelling free tier, because it just makes it that much easier to find your customers and upgrade them.
Yeah. So I think about three reasons for having freemium, other than just being very generous and altruistic, which some, frankly, there are many, many free subscriptions out there that have a founder who just cares a lot about that community or that cause or that goal and does it for free. So there are a lot, and a lot of nonprofits as well, where they're just trying to break even. But assuming that you're trying to run a business, freemium, number one, there is often a viral effect, meaning that when I play, maybe even organically, I'm bringing in other people, either organically because, like email, right, which is the original example of virality, I send you an email and at the bottom it says, check out Hotmail, right? And then you sign up because that's cool and it's free.
Hotmail. Wow, that's a long time ago.
I know. Well, that was the original. That was the original example of viral growth.
Don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone. I still have my Hotmail account, but that's for like my business uses. I know. That's right. Don't send me emails, please. It goes to spam, most of it.
So that's a great reason to have a freemium model. Second great reason to have a freemium model is if there's a network effect. That is, for each paying person, each free person, each non-paying person that joins, creates more value for the people who are paying, right? If nobody else was on LinkedIn, right, it wouldn't be valuable to the recruiters and the salespeople and the job seekers who are willing to pay for their subscription. And then the third reason is what you described, or what you have described, which is that you're driving behavior change. People don't think they're going to need the product as much as they actually do, and they keep bumping up against a paywall and eventually realize, wow, I actually really do use this a lot.
And to your second point around the network effects, I mean, that's huge at chess.com, right? Because again, we have tens of millions of people on the site. To your point, I get value from everyone else who joined. And, you know, the best example is at any time of the day, no matter where you are in the world, if I want to play a live game, and we have so many variations of live games, right? You can do a fast game, a slow game, blitz, rapid, different variants. within 5 seconds, if not less, I will be paired with someone else. And that ability, and by the way, I mean, our technology and the product team that enables that is unbelievable. We spend so much time and energy to make sure that you can do that is huge. And I think that's a lot of the value of the chess.com. And that's why community is a huge pillar of what we do as a company. But sorry, you were going to ask something, Robbie.
The thing I was going to ask you is, of those three elements, do you do all three? Do you do two? Do you do one?
Yeah. So obviously I talked about number three. Number two is huge. And number one being the viral, I mean, absolutely. Certainly when some person uses chess.com, they're marketing it. Our app is a viral marketing tool. Like if you're on the subway and you see someone using chess.com and because it's free, they can easily be like, oh yeah, let me play. Like the number of times that my friends have seen me play and they're like, oh, I want to download it. I want to play. Just bam, done. And then we can play a game right away. So those connections, and like we spend a lot of effort, this is not the subscription side of things, but on friends, on connecting. You set up a friends on chess.com and have a friend network, and you can play with your friends. You can play with strangers. So yes, that, and then we have clubs and we have communities, and you can have your own community. You can have your own chess club. So setting up all of that network and virality is huge, whether it's on the free tier or the paid tier. But then yes, to your point, from a paid perspective, my acquisition costs are relatively low because I've got this pool of already existing customers on the free tier.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of analogies in what you're saying to another guest that we had on the show, David Lorsch, Chief Revenue Officer at Strava,
yep,
which is also a very mission-driven organization.
Yep. We love Strava.
Connect the world's athletes. I mean, it's a lofty goal. And
how many chess players are hardcore athletes, by the way, both professional and casual. Like there's something about the passion. I'm always amazed by how in shape chess players are, maybe even more than wrestlers, but don't tell them I said that.
Fascinating. No, that's fascinating. So there's a lot of overlap there. It's funny. One of my next guests that I haven't really talked about yet on the show, but he's at Crunchyroll, which is another one of my favorite subscription, kind of niche subscription businesses. And he was telling me about the overlap between anime fans and sports fans and elite athletes.
Yes.
And it was sort of the same thing. He's like, we do great with the NFL. We do great with the NBA.
Crunchyroll was a partner of WWE when I was there. So there was a lot of overlap there as well. So I'm not surprised.
Wow. I wonder if there's something about people who get something out of fandom, having these interests. That's so funny. Yeah. So when we were preparing for this conversation, you said something to me that really struck me. You said three-tier companies want a single tier, and subscriptions with just one tier want to expand and personalize. As a revenue officer, I think you're constantly going back and forth between how can we get the last penny? How can we optimize for each customer's willingness to pay, ability to pay, desire for value, recognition of value, with keeping things simple, both for the subscriber, right? Because if I have to keep my wits about me, I always say this, if I have to keep my wits about me to figure out what the right program is for me, how can I relax and trust you? And then on your side with your team, as you're trying to understand, I mean, 35 million users, keeping track of it and trying to understand trends, if every one of them is paying a different amount and getting a different feature set, how do you even know what's working? So how do you balance that? And how should a revenue officer think about their own monetization strategies, where to start, and then what to do as you try to expand revenue?
Right. Gosh, there's a lot to unpack there. And I guess we'll focus on the subscription specifically side of revenue and as opposed to broader. So to your first point, I'll just say a lot of people and companies ask me, or we ask each other, what is the model for subscription packages or tiers that works? What's the right answer? And the joke I made was that chess.com right now, we have three tiers, and each tier has a monthly and a yearly option. So it's six SKUs in total. And we'll talk to a company with one tier and we'll say, oh, how do you guys do that? Because we think maybe we should be one tier, make it simple for everyone. And they'll say, wait, we wanted to ask you how you guys do three tiers because we need to diversify our offerings more. So I'm always hesitant to say, like, this is the right package or right plan for a subscription product. I think it depends on your audience and on your business goals, et cetera. But despite that, and you used the word simple, that I think is one of the most important things. And it's not brain surgery, of course. This is pretty obvious. But you want to make sure that whether it's one tier or three tiers, that it is very clear what the value proposition is of that subscription service and what the different value propositions are for your three different tiers. And I think that's one of the things when I started chess.com that wasn't so clear. We had a little bit of a mix of different numbers of lessons in one and then more lessons in the other. And you look at our tier structure and it was a little bit, as a user, I would be like, well, I'm not sure exactly why I want gold versus platinum versus diamond. So one of the first things we did is we made much clearer demarcations between what, again, our three tiers are gold, platinum, diamond, of what they were. And I don't want to overplay this because it's not so cookie cutters I'm about to say, but we somewhat tried to make them different for different types of audience. So people who wanted to have a bit more fun and were a bit more into puzzles were in gold tier. And people who were into wanted to learn and really analyze their games were in the higher tier. So we moved game review to the higher tiers. So it was much easier to say, okay, I can now look at your membership page, more easily understand the differences between your different tiers and pick. So that's kind of, again, while I'm not going to tell anyone you need to have one tier, two tier, three tiers, et cetera, monthly, annual, I do think make sure it's very easy to understand the differences and make sure the value proposition is there, especially in a subscription business, because I might buy a shirt, thought it was great, and then obviously it wasn't great, and well, I'm out $30, but I'm never going to buy that shirt again. But a subscription, obviously, you need them to have value and keep value. And so a lot of people, I think it's people say, well, how do you acquire and retain subs? It all comes to two things, what I've always seen in my career, and all the, whether it was cable, content, or chess game. It's about price and the product, right? The other things that we spend time on, and we should, whether it's customer care or whether it's getting the right special offer or the right marketing message, all of them are important. But at the end of the day, especially with subscription, they're going to come and they're going to leave if they're feeling like the product is not valuable enough or it's too expensive. So that's kind of my always message to subscribers, like subscription businesses. Keep it simple. Make sure your value proposition is there and steady. And obviously make sure the price is right so it's affordable. Again, maybe quite obvious, but sometimes I'm surprised when I look at some subscription products that it's not clear exactly what I'm getting and why I should stay.
Right. There's two different moments. There's the acquisition moment where it's good enough to get them to try, but then there's a retention moment after moment after moment that you have to keep a subscriber different from you buy the shirt. And if you spill spaghetti sauce on it the first time, that's your problem, right? And if you wear it out and feel scratchy or it doesn't feel like the right thing to wear for work, it's too bad, it's yours. But with subscription, if you subscribe, let's say, to Rent the Runway or one of the other many now, newly, all the new subscription-based clothing companies, if you don't like the assortment they give you, you're going to cancel. So that moment of transaction is just the starting line.
Yep.
And the product really matters.
What I think is kind of cool about chess, like any subscription service, you have to keep the value. So you often have to introduce new features. Or if you're a content company like WWE, you have to keep introducing new content. At chess, yes, we are always innovating and we are always introducing new features to keep things fresh, whether it's on the free side or on the premium side. But the beautiful thing is the game of chess is over 1,000 years old and in itself just has this natural little, and you can learn the same game. I mean, I've been playing very intensely now for over 3 years. It's the exact same game. And every day it's a different experience. I'm learning something new. So there's a natural sense of it actually feeds itself well to a subscription model, because even without the product changing, I feel like it's a brand new product almost every single day.
Amazing. Do you have time? We've talked for quite a while and there's a lot of other questions I could ask you, but...
Go ahead. No, I'm good.
Are you good? Okay. Do you have time for a speed round?
Uh-oh. I wasn't warned about this, but yes, let's do it.
First subscription you ever had?
The Economist in college. Oh my God, that's so embarrassing. My professor of macroeconomics told us all to get The Economist. So I did. And I used to really read it hardcore.
That's amazing. They have a really interesting subscription strategy. A couple of things that they've innovated on. One of them is newsletters to make what was a periodical into a daily or even hourly. And the other thing that I love that they've done is that they've moved when they do B2B. So if you, let's say, bought The Economist, subscribed for your whole team or your whole company, you only have to pay for the people that are actually using it.
Ah, see,
they have so much conviction that their product is good.
Well, that's actually brilliant. I think a lot of people I remember in college, they'd have The Economist on their shelves, but they didn't actually read it. It was kind of, you know, a little bit of a trophy. But yes,
there is a signaling factor to The Economist for sure.
Absolutely.
Okay, your favorite subscription today, other than chess.com?
I am a New York Times addict. I subscribe to the physical paper on weekends. Of course, I subscribe to the digital paper, all digital content all week. I use the New York Times games. We have a competition within chess.com for Spelling Bee and Wordle. We don't do connections yet. So I am a huge New York Times advocate, reader, fan.
Awesome. A subscription that has inspired you with its freemium model?
I think Duolingo has a really good freemium model. My daughter uses it. I use it. It's a great free service, and she has not subscribed yet. I subscribed at one point, although I'm not currently a subscriber. So yeah, I think they do it really well, where they give you, just like chess.com, a product you can stay free for as long as you want and still get value, but enough taste of the premium that makes you want to upgrade if you're willing and can afford it.
Your wrestling name, if you had one.
The Flying Jew? Can I say that? Or is that not PC? Uh-oh, we might have to edit that out.
I don't know how many wrestling names are PC, so that's fine. Your favorite game other than chess?
I love the game I haven't played in a long time, Halo on Xbox. In business school, we used to play like 10 of us. This was before it was like the original Halo. You couldn't even do it wasn't even online. You'd have to do a local area network. And we would literally bring 4 televisions to someone's apartment or dorm, hook it all up via Ethernet, and we'd play. It got so popular that a professor started joining us as well. So I loved Halo. I'm trying to get my kids into it now. It's not as hot as it used to be, but we'll see.
Okay, last question. Advice to another CRO trying to balance a strong mission with a desire to be self-sustaining or even profitable as an organization?
Yeah, my advice would be those are not necessarily conflicting goals. And at first, my own experience, at first glance, I was like, oh, those are going to be fighting the whole time. But in fact, they're complementary of each other. A very strong mission, and if everyone's focused on the mission, will lead to strong revenue and strong profits. And strong revenue and strong profits will help support and grow the mission. So they're actually very symbiotic, and don't be scared of trying to grow revenue in a mission-driven company. Embrace it, and it actually, they feed each other and it's great. And it also makes you feel better in the morning when you wake up to know that you're not just trying to make money for money's sake. You're actually helping a cause and hopefully helping lots of people enjoy life. And in my case, enjoy this amazing game.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And the great thing about working in so many subscription businesses is the business model itself sort of forces you to take care of your customer for the long term, which makes money, but also gets you out of bed in the morning feeling good about what you're about to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Adam Mayer, thank you so much for being a guest on Subscription Stories. It's been a pleasure.
Robbie, this is great. I learned a lot, and it's great to talk with you.
That was SVP of Monetization at Chess.com, Adam Mayer. For more about Chess.com, go to Chess.com. And for more about subscription stories, as well as a transcript of my conversation with Adam, go to robbiekelmanbaxter.com/podcast. Also, I have a favor to ask. If you like what you heard, please take a minute to go over to Apple Podcasts or Apple iTunes and leave a review. Mention Adam and this episode if you especially enjoyed it. Reviews are how listeners find our podcast, and we appreciate each one. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening to Subscription Stories.